Let's visit a park that is considered the top of a staircase. They don't talk about mountains and valleys, but instead hoodoos and amphitheaters. Join us as we explore Bryce Canyon National Park. I'm your host, Missy Rentz, and this is the Parks Podcast. I'd like to welcome Peter Densmore, who's the Visual Information Specialist at Bryce Canyon National Park. Peter, welcome to the Parks Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're going to start with some park stats on Bryce Canyon. The park is located in Paunsagunt Plateau. It is the 17th national park that was created in the national park system. It started as a national monument on June 8th, 1923, but then became Bryce Canyon National Park on September 15th, 1928, when Calvin Coolidge was president of the United States. The park is 35,835 acres. In 2022, there were 2,354,660 visitors to the park. Some fun facts about Bryce Canyon: it's home to mule deer, pronghorn, mountain lion, Utah prairie dogs, among others. Only the toughest flowers and plants will survive in this environment. It's home to 78 miles in the trail system. Bryce Canyon has the greatest concentration of hoodoos on Earth, and we're definitely going to talk about that. It's got the longest running astronomy interpretation program in the National Park Service since 1969. Bryce Canyon is located at the top of what is called the Grand Staircase, which is a series of colorful cliffs stepping down from Bryce Canyon to the Grand Canyon and containing a record number over 200 million years of ancient environmental and fossil records. And one thing I found fascinating is that Bryce Canyon is not a canyon. In fact, it is a series of natural amphitheaters. Peter, I love this park. It was the first park I went to on my year-long adventure because people said you have to go to Bryce Canyon in the wintertime. I wanted to know, why was it designated a park?
So it's a great question and a good place to start. Bryce Canyon was established first as a national monument, as you mentioned, and then later as a national park, really around these otherworldly rock formations that are called hoodoos today. Bryce Canyon protects and conserves resources integral to this landscape that contains the world's greatest concentration of these rock spires. Hoodoos can be found on pretty much every continent, but here at Bryce Canyon, you'll find more of them, and I dare say kind of some of the most imagination stoking of them anywhere on the planet. And so it starts with the rocks, but in preserving those, we've protected quite a lot else, from human history to an intact ecosystem, the ecology of the place, night skies, other things that I'm sure we'll chat about.
Yeah. Okay. I got to dive into hoodoos because it was a foreign word to me. How would you describe them?
Yeah, so a hoodoo in its simplest form is a tall spire of rock, and they typically are composed of at least two layers of rock. What you would see in that case would be almost like a toadstool shape, where you have a harder, a more erosion-resistant rock layer on top of a softer layer of rock. And so as erosion is working on both layers, the softer one is going to disappear more quickly, creating this irregular shape where it's thinner at the base, and then you've kind of got this head on it. Now, at Bryce Canyon, the hoodoos are being formed from the Clairon Formation, which originated in the Eocene age 60 million years ago to about 40 million years ago as a freshwater lake and floodplain system. And over these millions of years, you had water rising and falling, depositing sands, clays, muds in alternating layers. And these alternating layers are now eroding. We call it differential erosion when the layers erode at different rates. And at Bryce, the number of layers going on there, not to mention their color and everything else that draws the eye to them, creates really a regular shape that the imagination can play with. It's almost like cloud watching in stone in some way, especially if you were to speed it up. But it's changing very quickly as these soft rocks are chiseled away by the forces of erosion. At Bryce, ice is one of the principal mechanisms of that. But at Bryce Canyon, you get incredibly charismatic hoodoos, and you get a lot of them.
So when I'm standing on any of the many overlooks and I look out and see all of these beautiful red, orange formations, those are all predominantly hoodoos, those pillar type rocks.
Yeah, at Bryce, as you mentioned, the Paunsagunt Plateau is where Bryce Canyon is located. It's actually the eastern edge of it. And so most all of the views in the park are along the eastern edge of that plateau, looking down over the edge. And essentially, as the edge of the plateau, which is comprised of this colorful Clairon formation, as it erodes back, the harder rocks left behind are protecting softer ones and creating these big bowls called amphitheaters. These amphitheaters are filled with the rock spires. Now, when a hoodoo actually is born, so to speak, there can be some debate. How tall does it really need to be to become a hoodoo? Because you've got ones that are the size of city buildings and ones that are maybe the height of your hand in all these various stages of development. So because of this reason, the park doesn't have an official number of how many hoodoos there really are. I would say uncounted thousands, and it would probably come down to exactly how you're defining the stages of hoodoo formation.
And we've talked several times about this whole amphitheater, and I think amphitheater, and I think, oh, I'm going to see a concert there, and that is not what this is at all. So when it comes to the geological reference, what is an amphitheater, and why is it an amphitheater, not a canyon?
Yeah, so as far as why it's not a canyon, we can start there. As you visit this part of the continent, when you go to national parks in the desert southwest, you'll find a lot of canyons, from Grand Canyon to nearby Zion Canyon. And when you think about those, the question to ask is, what's at the bottom of the canyon that's forming it? And you've got the Colorado River, you've got the Virgin River. But here at Bryce Canyon, there is no river running through the feature that we're describing as a canyon. The nearest river is the Paria River, which is forming a valley further east of the park. The park is kind of the west edge of the valley. And so what's happening here instead is erosion primarily through rain and melting snow. We're at the very top of two major watersheds. To the east, where all the hoodoos are, all the water that falls and flows through there is headed to the Colorado River. All the water that falls and flows on top of the plateau in the Ponderosa Forest goes west to Nevada, to the Great Basin, and evaporates out there. So only rain and snow that are falling along the eastern edge are contributing to this erosion. But these rocks are so soft that it doesn't take much to start getting this sort of bowl-like shape that forms along the edge of the plateau. If you were to kind of ball up your hand and then spread your fingers out, it's the same sort of pattern forming in the edge of the plateau as rain and melting snow kind of claw bit by bit at the edge of the plateau. And there are these drainages that only run with water when there's rain and melting snow. There's some springs and seeps, but for the most part, all the drainages are dry most of the year, but continue to push back at a rate of about 1 to 4 feet every century. So the rim is moving back pretty quickly in expanding these amphitheaters all along the edge of the plateau. There's 12 to 14 major ones along the edge of the park. And what's interesting, the Southern Paiute words for Bryce Canyon that various bands have used, many of them make reference to a bowl or a hole that these rocks are standing within. So there's a recognition there that this isn't quite the same geologic feature as, say, Zion Canyon or Grand Canyon.
So it begs the question, why the name?
Why the name Bryce Canyon? Yeah, I mean, there's obviously two parts to it. The first part comes from a early settler from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Ebenezer Bryce, who was homesteading in the valley east of the park in the 1870s for only about 5 years. But he was a pretty beloved member of the community, and the name sort of stuck for what was essentially his backyard, behind the cabin where he would go up to run cattle and harvest timber, would later become the national park. But locals got to know it as Bryce's Canyon. As far as the canyon part of it, yeah, it's a common term for kind of these narrow V-shaped areas. And within the amphitheater, you've got a lot of those. flat canyons, they often get described as well, sort of these narrow areas within it. So you could make the argument that there's hundreds of tiny little canyons within the amphitheater, but the feature taken as a whole is better described with the amphitheater name. Now, why not call it something else? I've heard one geologist who worked here say that the more accurate name for this place would be Bryce Eroding Retreating Plateau Margin, but that does not sit on hats and t-shirts and mugs in quite the same way. So as with most national parks, there are considerations of marketing and kind of bringing these places into public consciousness. And the shorter name just seemed to work out better for this place in terms of its national park history.
Now, in thinking about him, Ebenezer, and the Ebenezer Bryce and the homesteading, the other thing that is fascinating to me when reading about the park is people living there. You guys have an amazing section on the website that you go into the people that live there, but I can't imagine that environment for living.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is a challenging environment. We're at 8,000 feet here where I am at the visitor center. The park goes up to just over 9,000 feet. We are closely tied to Rocky Mountain ecosystems and weather over here. So we see considerable snowfall in the winter. And in the summer, this area is actually one of the more pleasant, I could say, areas to be compared to the lower deserts where temperatures easily exceed 100 degrees. There's sort of a natural air conditioning with this high elevation. But yeah, it's really the winter that you don't really see year-round habitation through the winter until you start seeing homestead. There's not an archaeological record, nor many stories that have been shared with me about habitation here in the winter. So Bryce Canyon was more of a place of seasonal bounty where you could move between your home is the entire region, these traditional homelands, but in different seasons, you might be returning to different parts of it. And so Bryce Canyon would be a part that would most likely be returned to in the spring. And again, at 8,000 feet, spring here can be more May, June. The season is delayed a little bit into about this time of year, the snow is returning. I usually think of snow really arriving at Bryce on a typical winter, more in January. But it's all about following plants and animals, following that game and returning to places where there are reliable food crops and such. So there's records here archaeologically going back at least 12,000 years from hunting mammoths to more modern habitation, the Southern Paiute people for whom this has been a traditional homeland since time immemorial. You can see lots of archaeological record of their presence in this place. And of course, that presence continues to this day.
Are there areas of the park that people consider the park sacred lands?
Absolutely. I think when you talk to most Native American tribes, the idea of the sacred, the entire traditional homeland is often described as sacred. It's a matter of defining the word. And so absolutely, when we're talking about affiliated tribal partners, I keep returning to the Southern Paiute, to whom there's an especially close connection. This is a place that's visited for sacred ceremonial purposes, both in person and remotely through ceremonies and such. And so that continues very vividly to this day. And then when you consider the American definition of the sacred, I think that's another interesting conversation. I dare say our national parks are kind of the stewards of much of what the nation would consider sacred in terms of being core to its identity and its own story. And the things that kind of elevate its citizenry and people from around the world to the ideals and aspirations that we hold in high esteem. And so I think there's a lot of ways to define the word, but I would say that this is absolutely a sacred place.
Yeah, I definitely relate to the way that I see nature and outdoors in our national parks in a sacred way. And whenever I'm in a park and there are visible signs of Native tribes' sacred ceremonies, it always gives me pause and it always gives me great time to reflect on those ceremonies and what it means to them. And I don't know, it's to be cherished. I think they're so beautiful when you see visible proof of those ceremonies.
Absolutely. And talking to members of the Southern Paiute tribe, there's reference to the fact that every environment has a spirit. And part of being human and recognizing and honoring the sacred is to recognize the spirit of a place and to respect that. And in some traditions, offerings to that, just various ways of acknowledging that you are in a place in which there is much more than a human component to what is present.
Really beautiful. Another thing in the park are the animals and the plants. And these are extreme conditions. I said I was there in snow. It was March, so I definitely relate to spring starting later there. But I've also been in the region in the super hot summers. And when you look around, there are trees and there's green life, but you'd have to be pretty hardy and pretty strong to survive in this area.
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges for life, and that's led to lots of beautiful adaptations in response. When you're talking about plants, the colorful clairon formation, beautiful to look at, but it's hardly what we would call soil in other areas. There's more of a rocky, clayey substrate that most of the plants are growing in. So to be able to survive through the shrinking and expansion of those clayey soils and the limited water, and in some cases, the high levels of certain kinds of minerals and chemicals can really push out other plants and allow others that are adapted to them to survive. The bristlecone pine is such a great example of resiliency and adaptation in challenging environments. This is the longest living non-clonal species on the planet. Bryce Canyon has populations of the Great Basin bristlecone pine. This grows typically on, if you're in the park and looking for them, you'd want to be looking for more white areas where you've got more pure limestones, dolomitic limestones. They're more rich in magnesium. This can make it challenging for other plants, but for these slow growing survivors who can grow a centimeter in a century if the conditions aren't ideal, they can really put everything on pause and hold on to the nutrients they have, that they are able to grow slowly in these areas, not being outcompeted and overshadowed as might happen if they were growing in you know, more generous soil and things like that. There's also adaptations to things like fire. Ponderosa pines that dominate the park have evolved through frequent low-intensity fire, and that kind of to their healthiest expression. So obviously the park works to mimic these conditions and use fire to kind of continue to play to these adaptations. When you're talking about life in general, in the winters, we're 2 days away from the start of that season when we're talking here. But migration, hibernation, and resistance are kind of three ways of categorizing how life can respond. Some of our wildlife, some of our birds are going to migrate as far south as, you know, Central America or South America. Others are just going to go lower in the local area. Mountain bluebirds and robins become less present here on the plateau, but I can drive 30 minutes, drop a couple thousand feet in elevation, and find them down in the lower sagebrush spending the winter. Deer, similarly, when the snow gets too high to kind of move through, and when the browsing plants are buried, they'll move down lower and then come back up as it warms up. You've got black bears hibernating in the park. You've got other creatures going into kind of a partial hibernation state, like the small squirrels and chipmunks. And then, of course, resistance, as we talk about. Things like the plants are a great example of that, being able to go into dormant states, or the evergreens using proteins to avoid ice kind of carving up their vascular system. There's all kinds of ways that life has found a way to survive in the challenging environment. So, and then obviously for people, now that we're seeing this year-round habitation, we could talk more about what I think you should bring for a winter visit here too.
We definitely
not only survive, but thrive and enjoy your.
Right. One thing that is celebrated at Bryce Canyon is air quality in the region. Why is it so good there?
Well, the primary reason is remoteness. Okay. Bryce Canyon is pretty far from a lot of the sources of air pollution that we see, industrial sources and natural sources to some extent. With wildfires and such, obviously that can be a source of air pollution. Dust storms and things like that can have an effect as well. We have been monitoring our air quality for decades. All national parks over 6,000 acres are considered class one airsheds under the Clean Air Act since 1977. And so we have this duty to monitor and share that data and participate in decisions that are being made in the region that may have an effect on the park's air quality. Being at this high elevation can both be a way of avoiding air quality. Maybe down in the lower valleys, you might see inversions when the conditions are just right to kind of trap air pockets. Bryce Canyon is really at the top of so many things. And so you're often looking down, but there can also be high elevation regions that can increase air pollution with increased UV radiation that can interact with particles in the air and create pollution as well. So it's a complex situation with the park's air quality, but it is incredibly clean, enabling things like long vistas and views into its dark night sky. But it does require regular monitoring so that we can recognize if that trend is going in a negative direction.
And in the monitoring, is there also a desire to like learn and replicate in other parts of the country, or could it even be replicated?
I don't know of any plans to kind of take, I think to your point, the conditions that can define air quality in different parts of the country can be so unique, you know, from the topography that's at play to, yeah, sources of pollution, where those are coming from. I lived in the Salt Lake Valley for 6 years, and that's certainly a place where you can see how topography and sources of pollution can come together to create quite a thick haze in that area. And so Bryce Canyon isn't really actively doing anything to clean it there. The plants and many of the things the park's protecting are helping with that. We are more useful for kind of gathering that data, one, to help continue the clean air that Bryce Canyon enjoys, to protect that and recognize things that could diminish it. But yeah, perhaps that data could be very useful for people that are looking for solutions in other areas, especially if they share things in common with Bryce Canyon.
Okay. I love night skies. I love the night sky viewings, and I did not get to participate in one at Bryce Canyon, but I've got to think that your night skies are unbelievable.
Yes. I mean, when we're talking about the clean air and the high elevation, those two things, along with our remote location, can create some of the darkest night skies in the country. You can find darker night skies than Bryce Canyon in some especially remote areas, but I would say that among areas that you can reach via a paved road, so accessible night sky viewing, Bryce Canyon is one of the best that you can find in the country. And the night skies here are of such high quality that in 2019, we were recognized as an international dark sky park. And that considers all kinds of things from our interpretive programs. So those night sky programs, those are typically offered Memorial Day to Labor Day is when you're more likely to see the park offering those. But also, what are we doing to address light pollution within the park? Shielding lights, changing bulbs out. There's a whole list of things that are done to help preserve and even continue to improve Bryce Canyon's night sky. Mentioned earlier that we've been interpreting the night sky here since 1969. So it's a long tradition that we're very proud of. Our annual astronomy festival is certainly a good time to come out if Bryce Canyon's night skies are one of your main reasons for visiting. That's held around the new moon in June. So new moon, you're not going to have any moonlight at night, so you get especially dark skies. If you're not coming for the astronomy festival, but just want to enjoy it on your own, pretty much everywhere in the park is great for night sky viewing. Some of the darkest areas of the park are a little further south, places like Perea View and Whiteman Bench. But you'll want to keep in mind sort of the time of year that you visit and the time of month that you visit. The moon cycle can have a big impact on how many stars are visible. You can see well over 7,500 stars on a new moon night, but as the full moon comes into its phase, that's going to kind of overpower a lot of the stars, creating magical conditions all its own. Bryce Canyon also does full moon ranger-led hikes. You can imagine seeing the spires of the hoodoos illuminated by moonlight. You don't even need a headlamp.
Get an August super moon and you probably feel like you can touch it.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and those moon rises, my favorite night of the month, typically for sunsets, is the night before the full moon. So the full moon rises as the sun sets. That's just how the relationship is between the sun and the moon. But the night right before the full moon, the moon is going to come up a little bit before the sun is completely gone, and you'll get this big, beautiful moon rising up through the earth's shadow and any colors in the evening sky as the sun is going down. And so you really get this beautiful balance of these two main light sources in the planet. The stars are here. It's so dark that they say Jupiter can cast a shadow. I'm not exactly sure how they measure that. I think it's just the illumination coming visibly from the planet versus what it would take to produce a shadow is enough here because of how dark it is. But the very last thing I'll say is seasonally, the Milky Way, which a lot of people are coming to view, that shifts throughout the year too. So to see the vivid galactic core and sort of the brightest Milky Way, you'd want to come between June and November for kind of the easiest viewing of that. As you get into late December into March and April, the winter Milky Way is visible. So we're not looking toward the center of the galaxy. We're looking out at kind of the only other arms that are further out than us, and they're much dimmer. And the attraction of that, I would say, is that when you consider the number of people that have seen the Milky Way, this number is constantly falling off as we see more and more light pollution in areas where the majority of the population lives. That number is small, but the number of people who have come and seen the winter Milky Way or seen it anywhere is even smaller than that. You have to be in a truly dark place for those outer bands of the Milky Way to be visible. So if you come in the winter and you're able to see that, you should consider yourself part of a very small, select number of people that have had the privilege of being able to see that.
That's incredible. So that kind of leads us nicely into planning a trip. Is there a place where people can go, maybe on the website, where they can learn about any programs around the night sky viewing or the astronomy programs?
Yeah, absolutely. Each park is going to have pages about its ranger programming, and often you'll find links there to kind of the types of programs that are being offered. There's also calendar pages where you can look on the specific day you're going to be there and see what's being offered. So the national park websites are such a fantastic resource when you're planning your trip. We spend a lot of time on developing content to help you plan like a park ranger is the phrase that we use. And each national park website really has three major sections. One is plan your visit. So that's going to have all that basic information, everything from camping to ranger programs to accessibility information and so on. The other section is learn about the park. So that's more if you're like a lot of what we've been talking about, going into the natural, the cultural history of the park and learning more deeply about what's protected within the park. And then finally, there's a get involved section. So if you've been inspired to not just visit the parks, but to help share them with the world, you'll find information on volunteering, working with the park, and planning efforts going on within the park as well.
So when someone decides, okay, I'm going to go, they listen to this episode and they say, I'm going to go to Bryce Canyon. They've gone to the website, they've gone to the app, so they've done their research. What would you tell someone to do when they're first starting to plan a trip?
Well, the website is great because we're trying to make you aware of all the things that you might have not even known that you should know about. And obviously, beyond the Park Service website, there's numerous blogs, resources like your podcast that can really help people get started with that. Figuring out some of the basic facts, obviously, like the typical weather and climate for the park is going to help you pack for your trip. Some areas like the Southwest here, depending on when you visit, you can end up probably wanting a wide variety of things in your bag. You might come in May and Zion is getting into the 80s, maybe the 90s. Bryce Canyon might still have snow flurries coming through. So depending on the parks you're trying to link together, it can definitely get more complex there. You can also interact with the parks on social media. A big part of my job here at Bryce is running the park's social media. Parks vary in terms of how they respond to comments or messages, but here at Bryce, we do respond to all of our social media messages. So if you do have questions, that's one way to get in touch. There's also main phone numbers and email addresses, so you can contact the parks directly if your questions are being answered by the website.
If you're a newbie and you're just venturing out into parks, it can be really intimidating when you plan, and you can kind of feel, at least I did, I felt almost like my questions were silly or something, and I was kind of embarrassed to ask them. But I have found that park rangers love to talk about their parks, and they love to help people explore. So I think one thing that I really want this podcast to do is help people get comfortable with just reaching out, because you want people there. You want to answer these questions because this is the life you live.
That's right. Some people like to use the expression parks are for people. See, parks are for the more than human world too, but there is in our mission, our mandate, we are providing for the enjoyment of this and future generations. So we are here for you, the visitor, someone planning your visit, or someone here enjoying the park. And I think of the national parks in many ways as sort of these accessible gateways, the kind of experiences of the natural world that include, but also go beyond the national parks. I think coming to a park is a way of experiencing the outdoors with a lot of resources available to kind of support you and your curiosity as you get to know it. There's certainly danger and other things to be aware of in national parks, and your own safety is always something to keep in mind. That's first and foremost your responsibility when visiting these places. There are wild animals, as people would expect. But within that, there's also a lot of infrastructure, and part of that is the park ranger. We are here to help introduce you to this place and help you along the way as you form your own relationship with it. So yes, I completely agree with you that people should take the advice. There are no silly questions. We want people to get in touch with their curiosity and also to be prepared to have a positive experience while they're here.
So do you need to plan in advance, or can you just pop in to Bryce Canyon?
Bryce Canyon does not have any form of entrance reservation system in place. So I'm only saying that for the sense that logistically, yeah, you could just pop in at Bryce Canyon anytime you want. If you're coming in the summer or May through October, I definitely recommend things like the free park shuttle as a way to get around. But you're welcome anytime, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. Now, that all said, I think you're going to have a much more enriching visit if you do spend some time to decide what is piquing your interest about this place and how might you interact with that through the various activities available in the park. And again, the park website is a great place to start finding out how people interact and enjoy these places and how you might want to yourself.
Are there peak times, or are there times that should be avoided coming to the park?
Well, the peak, there's different kind of ideas as to when that really starts. Spring break in March, after relatively quiet winter months, January and February, you can experience some pretty profound silence and solitude here, if that's what you're looking for. With March, we start to see more visitation around spring break. And then as you get into Memorial Day, that's often the busiest weekend of the year. So holiday weekends, I would not say there's any time to avoid, but just being prepared for the levels of visitation that can come with holiday weekends, for instance. There's also pros to that as well. Often the ranger programming and such, we might try to be offering special programming at these times when we have high visitation. So yeah, pros and cons. Packing your patience is something we often remind people if you are visiting during those different times. All you really need to do to enjoy your visit. Now, within the summer months, honestly, August is often a lull, families starting to transition back to the school year and such. And so there's no hard and fast summer's busy, winter's not busy. You can have a day in the summer that just happened that the ebb and flow of people, that there weren't as many. But I would say, as a general rule, even on our busiest days, the majority of Bryce Canyon's visitors are here enjoying the viewpoints or walking along the rim trail. If you are interested and able to go on longer hikes, it's quite easy to find yourself with some solitude and quiet, even on a busy day. It just depends on the part of the park that you choose to visit.
What are lodging options at the park?
Well, there's the historic Bryce Canyon Lodge, built in the mid-1920s, the only original lodge of those built in this part of the country, Zion, Grand Canyon, Cedar Breaks. They were all connected through a tourism loop with the Union Pacific. And the Bryce Canyon Lodge is the only original of those still standing. They have the lodge as well as historic cabins that are all clustered around it. And those accommodations are a 2-minute walk to the edge of the plateau. So the location is very hard to beat there. Beyond that, of course, there's the campgrounds in the park. There are 2 developed campgrounds, North and Sunset. In the summer months, you're going to see a reservation system for both of those through recreation.gov. The North Campground, about 6 months in advance, or it's a 6-month window. So you could be booking for that season now, actually. It starts reservations in May. And then Sunset Campground, which is just recently moved to a 14-day window. So you can kind of play it a little bit closer. And of course, if there are vacant sites, you can treat those like first come, first serve sites. Those are the main lodging options within the park. And then you have numerous campgrounds and hotels and motels surrounding the park.
And then if you were coming, or when you, well, you do come to the park all the time, but if you were new to the park coming for the first time, what's the first thing you do when you got there?
I think like a lot of people, I'm a big fan of stopping by the visitor center. I enjoy watching the park film, walking through the museum. My wife and I like to collect little animal pins. A lot of parks often have pins for native species that can be found there. And then, of course, if I do have any questions, there's a ranger or volunteer working at the desk and can have a chat with them. And I think that's a big part of the park experience for a lot of people. They want to talk to the park ranger, to the person who lives there and has firsthand knowledge of the place, just to get their recommendations and check in on current conditions, which are usually also posted on information boards and such. So I'm a big fan of the visitor center as a way to start the visit.
I do too. And I think that I always do my planning in advance and have sort of mapped out what I think I'm going to do. And I bet if I went and looked most of the time, I never did what I had planned because a ranger would say, oh, this is a really good option today, or this trail's wet, maybe go a different route. And it's just always really nice to have a local knowledge in guiding what to do.
Absolutely. That's one of the big reasons we're here.
Okay. So I went in the winter, and I know that winter and summer are very different from an activity standpoint. So let's break it down into the seasons. Since we're in winter now, let's talk about what are key activities that can be done at Bryce Canyon in the wintertime.
Yeah. So a lot, of course, depends on snowfall, how much we get and when. Once we've got at least maybe 14 inches of snow, we'll often start offering ranger-led snowshoe hikes. But of course, this is something you can do on your own as well. If you have your own snowshoes, or you can rent them in nearby Bryce Canyon City, you're able to snowshoe and cross-country ski on top of the plateau. There's actually groomed cross-country ski trails kind of along the park's northern boundary that are beautiful. You can go through the Ponderosa Forest and get some views off of the plateau edge. Of course, people enjoy hiking all 4 seasons, but in winter, you'll find considerable ice most years below the rim on these trails, as well as on sidewalks and on top of the rim. So having traction devices and such, these chains that you can put on your shoes, or using hiking poles, these can be really useful to help with your stability and go out and enjoy that. And of course, there are other activities that pair really well with all those things, from photography to bird watching, and enjoying the natural quiet. Other activities in winter, I would think of, obviously, stargazing continues. And we talked a little bit earlier about some of the differences you're going to find with winter stargazing. But yeah, in many ways, a lot of the same activities that people are enjoying in summer are continuing in winter, just with different conditions.
What would you advise people for with coming in the wintertime?
Yeah, I think in the winter, that whole idea of planning ahead becomes especially important. And a lot of it is around the conditions, whether it's the road conditions or the trail conditions or just the air temperature and so forth. It can get pretty cold up here and roads can become snow-packed and icy, and of course the trails can too. When you're driving around the area, the Utah Department of Transportation has their website with all the web cameras on them so that you can kind of look at the road along your route. And that's a great asset. And of course, their plows are out there doing good work and using salt to kind of keep ice off of the road. But as you leave those state and county maintained roads and enter the park, often in winter, what you'll notice is that suddenly the road goes white. The park does not use salt to keep ice and snow off of the road because of the damaging effect it can have on plants, and also the way it draws wildlife onto roads can increase wildlife deaths. And so that means that having some comfort with winter driving, and really all I mean by that is understanding that things like stopping distances and speed should be modulated because the road surface can be a little less predictable. That said, the park does plow the roads all throughout the winter, making them accessible for all vehicles, really. It's just, again, being safe in the way that you're driving in the park. As far as clothing and preparing for that, we talked a little earlier about the traction devices. Having those for your shoes is a huge advantage for having a safe visit with those patches of ice and compacted snow. But also dressing in layers. You hear that a lot, but here at Bryce Canyon, I feel like it's true of any place that I've lived. At this high elevation, that sun comes out, it can be incredibly warming. But if you're out there hiking or, snowshoeing, which is even more strenuous, or cross-country skiing, it's nice to be able to shed layers and put them back on as you might want them. And then, of course, lastly, just being aware of conditions as they might relate to seasonal closures. The vast majority of Bryce Canyon remains open year-round, but we do have a couple short roads that close for the season. They actually close to allow people to ski in cross-country ski and snowshoe along them, or just hike. We do have one small trail closure, the Wall Street side of Navajo Loop, that closes due to increased rockfall risk, as the freezing and thawing of water can chisel these hoodoos apart in unpredictable ways, especially that time of year. And then finally, the main road will temporarily close. 18 miles long, the mile 3 gate will sometimes close during snowstorms. Basically, that just gives park snowplows a chance to clear the higher elevations of the southern park road before usually reopening that within a few days. So variables can shift, and the best way to keep up to date with all of it is the park's website.
One of the things I think was a little surprising to me was the accessibility of activities at Bryce Canyon. You just mentioned it, but the scenic drive is something that I think it is open for everybody. But also, I felt like there were activities that no matter if you're a young kid or if you have some physical struggles, there's ways to enjoy Bryce Canyon no matter what.
Absolutely. Yeah, Bryce Canyon is a very accessible park. And we do have a page on our website that goes through the various parts of the park and the accessibility options that are available there. But I think the accessibility is honestly one of the reasons that this is such a beloved national park. You can get out there into rugged, remote wilderness if that's what you're looking for. But the accessibility to the viewpoints along the rim of the plateau is an accessibility to views that can exceed 100 miles, the horizon limited just by the curvature of the earth. And the geologic diversity in this area is such that your eye can travel across miles and miles of canyons and plateaus and mesas and millions of years of sedimentary rock record without moving an inch yourself. You're really able to just take all that in, and the eye and the mind really have an adventure just, taking in all the detail in that landscape. And so being able to get out to those paved viewpoints, all but one of Bryce Canyon's viewpoints is paved with accessible grades getting out to them. So, and you've also mentioned just the range of opportunities there are for different ages as well. Would be remiss if I didn't plug the Junior Ranger program, which obviously you can find at lots of national parks. And that's open to all ages. We've had junior rangers in their 70s and 80s, and obviously plenty of younger folks as well. And so that's a great way to get to know the park and to be drawn in deeper to kind of your experience of it.
One of my favorite memories of my park visits has been at an overlook at Bryce Canyon, where it was lunchtime and I just backed into the overlook and popped out a chair and had a little peanut butter and jelly sandwich picnic and just watched the world go by for a little while. And it was one of the most spectacular experiences, very calm and quiet. It was wintertime, but very calm and quiet and relaxing. And so I think even if that's what you get to do, that is a gift that you're given at Bryce Canyon.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great people watching. We're part of the wildlife too, is one way to.
Exactly. Well, we end every episode with a speed round of questions. The idea is that just answer with the first thing that comes to mind. What is your earliest park memory?
Well, it would probably be going to Cuyahoga in Brandywine Falls there. I'm from the Midwest and have family in Ohio, but it wasn't actually a national park yet. That was established in 2000. So I'm not sure it counts. It would actually probably be Timpanogos Cave in 2013. It would have been hiking there while I was living in Salt Lake City, going up into the cave, seeing the heart of the mountain. And really getting to experience a national park that's much closer to the urban interface, which Bryce Canyon, one of the more remote ones. Certainly not the most remote, but it kind of made sense that my life was more based in cities at that time, and Timpanogos Cave was right there.
What made you love the parks?
Honestly, it was working at one. I mean, my national park relationship really began to take shape around my 30th birthday. I left the city of Chicago, where I'd been living and working and photo and video work there, and had a very depressing winter, a really challenging winter. And on the tail end of that, it's a very long, complex story, but found my way to a job here at Bryce as their centennial coordinator for the 2016 centennial. And getting to know the national park history and just preparing myself to become a park ranger. And then, of course, coming here and experiencing it firsthand. I mean, it's such a potent dose of the national park experience to work in one. And so I really got to know them at the same time that I started working in them. So they really came together that way.
What's your favorite thing about Bryce Canyon National Park?
It would probably be the intersection of the various geographic provinces and ecosystems that come together here. On top of the plateau, you've got a lot that's in common with the Rocky Mountains, kind of continuing from the Rocky Mountains out onto these high plateaus that you find in this part of Southwest Utah. But as you go down in lower elevation, lower parts of the park, you're getting into kind of the cold deserts of the Colorado Plateau, and you'll watch the plants and animals change as you come lower. As you go west, you're very quickly into the Great Basin ecosystems and everything you find in the Basin Range out there. So Bryce Canyon really sits at this point of intersection with right at the edge of a lot of these provinces. And so the intermingling and interactions and just juxtapositions of those things, I find really exciting and beautiful.
What is your favorite thing to do at Bryce Canyon National Park?
I'm really big into the plants. Honestly, photographing the plants within their environment here is really fun. The vivid colors of the Clarum Formation are such a beautiful background and such for these things. And the plants are so interesting and honestly, in a lot of cases, easy to overlook. They're very small plants in a lot of cases. Some of the rarest wildflowers are just right hugging the ground with these tiny flowers among the hoodoos. And so going out and trying to find those and to photograph them, just as a side effect of that, you get drawn into everything else. So they're a great gateway into enjoying the park.
What park have you yet to visit but is on your bucket list and why?
I think Canyonlands, I still haven't been to. It's just a little bit to the east. You talk about these five Southern Utah National Parks. That's the last one. And so a little bit cooler in the winter. So I may go there next month. But I would also say maybe Gates of the Arctic, something up in that area. I just finished reading Barry Lopez's Arctic Dreams and was really enchanted by that book. And some of the comparisons he even makes between the Arctic environment and desert environment, I find really sparked my imagination. So if I can make it up there, that would be fantastic.
What are three must-haves you pack for a park visit?
Well, I'm usually bringing my camera. That's a big part of how I connect with new environments and kind of capture what catches my eye. Binoculars are usually in there too for birding and wildlife viewing. And then typically my phone is there. And the big reason for that is a lot of the great apps and assets that are out there. One that I'll shout out is the Merlin birding app. They've got the algorithms and such figured out to the point that you can record your environment, and this app will recognize patterns in bird calls and song and will highlight the bird that it thinks it's hearing. And so it's very cool how some of this technology can really expedite your connection with a new environment or a familiar one.
What is your favorite campfire activity?
Obviously, if there are other people there, the company that can be shared over fire is great. And then the fire itself is mesmerizing. So there's plenty to enjoy there.
Tent, camper, or cabin?
I'm a tent camper. I like being able to hear the environment and to feel, I mean, maybe not even a tent, maybe just a sleeping pad and a sleeping bag, depending on the weather. I guess I kind of technically live in a cabin currently within the park too. So I do love that. And if I didn't live in a cabin, maybe that would be higher on the list.
Are you hiking with or without trekking poles?
Usually without. I like to have my hands free for things like photography and such, but certain conditions can make them a total lifesaver. In these icy, snowy conditions, or if there's a lot of uphill and downhill, I think you can really save your knees some strain. So it depends.
What is your favorite trail snack?
If it's just a simple thing, it would probably be pistachios. I mean, I guess they're technically not nuts, they're drupes, but I love them. But if it can be a little more complex, my wife will often make like a simple trail mix. And if you can get dates and cashews in there together, but I'm pretty happy.
What is the best animal sighting that you've seen?
I mean, so many. I do a lot of birding, in part because my wife is a really enthusiastic birder, and owls are always very striking life forms to have in interaction with. I remember being at lower elevations and hiking through juniper trees and stopping and looking up, and there being a northern saw-whet owl in this crook of a tree at eye level. And these owls are like the size of a softball. They're very small, but they have these yellow forward-facing eyes that just glare right into you, and just meeting the gaze of a small owl that was resting in the tree during the day was unforgettable. So that one comes to mind.
Owls are so elusive. Like I've never seen one. And I just feel like if you see one, it's like your lucky day.
There's a lot of beliefs and lore and such around owls, which I mean makes perfect sense to me. When you encounter one, there is a feeling of being gazed back at, and I don't know, you become self-conscious and not at the same time. It's an interesting experience. I'll have to give that more thought, but the encounter of meeting the gaze of an owl is something I hope everyone gets a chance to do.
What is your favorite sound in the park?
Generally, it's probably the wind in the ponderosa pine trees. The scale of this landscape is already kind of oceanic. It's so big, some of these views. But most of my time is in the woods, not at the rim where our cabin is located. And the wind through the trees creates an oceanic kind of sound, almost like soothing wave. And so I really appreciate that. And then as the birds come back, the migratory birds come back, there are birds here all year round, of course. But as the migratory birds start to return, the song of the hermit thrush, that's inspired poets for ages. It's a beautiful and haunting sound. And so when I can hear the hermit thrush in the ponderosa forest again, that feels like a peak Bryce experience to me.
And what is the greatest gift that the parks give to us?
Well, I think that there are national storytellers and keepers, whether that's the nation's history, its ecosystems, its failures, dreams, and its people. The national parks, from battlefields to national parks and the various sites of massacres and places that recognize struggles for human rights, and all these stories are contained in some way through our national parks. And so they provide places for people to not only learn about those stories and start to weave them together into a whole, but they also provide a space for dialogue, whether that's online or social media or within the park itself. I noticed that I think a lot of the divisions in our society, they don't exist as much with, or seem to exist as much within the space of the national parks. I feel like they're great gathering places where dialogue seems to still to be possible often. And I think it's kind of a sacred role of the National Park Service to help facilitate that dialogue and help people to understand their country and themselves and everyone else that make it up better, to build curiosity and empathy and wonder.
Peter, thank you so much for your time and your passion for the parks and for sharing the stories of Bryce Canyon National Parks with us today.
Yeah, thank you again for the opportunity to do it. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for today's episode. Until next time, we'll see you in the parks. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to like and share on your favorite podcast platform. Music for the Parks podcast is written, performed, and produced by Porter Hardy. For more information, please follow us on Instagram at The Parks Podcast or visit our website at theparkspodcast.com.